Troika-style spending curbs to return is the Irish Examiner's main front-page headline this morning, with detail that budget controls have been slapped on the biggest departments, including health, education and social protection. Daniel McConnell writes that this is all part of a need to cut an estimated €12 billion from state spending. He also writes that workers are to begin transitioning back from the €350 pandemic unemployment payment to the normal job seekers rate of €203 per week from June, as Public Expenditure Minister Michael McGrath seeks to wean the country off emergency COVID-19 spending. The Irish Daily Mail leads on "Don't mess it up now" above the story that Taoiseach Micheál Martin is urging the public to hang tight and stick with restrictions for another while longer to ensure the nation isn't hit with a new wave of COVID-19 and a fresh lockdown. And that theme is on the front of the Irish Times too this morning, with Jennifer Bray writing that the government will resist pressure to accelerate the planned summer reopening of the country amid concerns about a potential spike in COVID-19 infections. And the question of reopening is also on the mind of the Irish Independent's leader writer this morning. That paper carries an editorial which cautions against reopening too fast and urges us to ponder the perils of an ill-judged easing of virus restrictions. The editorial says it's clear that any short-term political gain for the government by an injudiciously paced easing of lockdown would be severely punished by the public if it leads to a fourth tight restrictions regime, adding that Taoiseach Micheál Martin must avoid any populist gestures. The death outside Garrettstown, County Cork, at the weekend of 22-year-old Conor King is covered on the front of the Irish Sun, the Mail and the Irish Daily Star and features across the papers this morning. The young man died after falling down a cliff blowhole near the old head of Kinsale. The Irish Independent's lead story is that the government is planning to allow up to 50 people at mass and regular religious services from mid-May, but not at funerals and weddings. From today, 25 people can attend a funeral and weddings remain at 6 guests. Senna Maloney writes that senior government sources accepted last night that such a decision may lead to accusations of mixed messages. A source close to the Taoiseach is quoted as saying that the difference is that people go home after an ordinary mass or service or ceremony in other faiths. Mass confusion is the headline there. And in features, the Examiner starts its Cork in 50 Artworks series today with a deep dive into the making of Murdoch MacLeod's iconic 2002 portrait, Roy Keane with Raven's Head. The striking portrait now hangs in the city's Crawford Art Gallery. And speaking to Elio Byrne about the day he took the picture, after earwigging the explosive interview Keane gave the Observer newspaper, Murdoch MacLeod recalls producing the raven's rotting skull from a polythene bag and showing Keane exactly how to hold it so the dead bird's beak framed the pupil of his right eye. The shutter fell, the timeless image was made, and moments later Keane returned the raven skull to the photographer and quietly departed, saying, "That's my taxi now."
Emergency services in County Kerry spent the weekend battling a wildfire at Killarney National Park, which is believed to have destroyed around 2,000 hectares, or the equivalent of 5,000 football pitches. The fire, which started on Friday night, burned through the park for a third night last night and has so far impacted some of the oldest oak trees in the country, as well as the nesting grounds of endangered birds. Efforts to put out the fire resumed in the last hour, and we can speak with the person at the centre of those efforts. That's Kerry's Chief Fire Officer Andrew McElwraith. Good morning, Andrew.
Good morning, Angus.
What's the scene like where you are this morning?
A lot better this morning. Yesterday we had three sectors burning. We had a low-level sector where there's some of the oldest oaks in Ireland. That was put out by our ground crews, which went across by boat with Killarney Water Rescue. The second sector was up on the top of East Ridge from Purple Mountain. There's still some burns there this morning, and we have one helicopter already dispatched that this morning and is working in that, dropping water on it. And then towards the Black Valley, we had a high-level air attack there yesterday, but because of the strong winds, it was still burning very heavily. It burnt down to a low level last night, coming towards when the light was about dusk time, and we got four crews in there, three of our own crews, supported by one Cork County crew. And by about 12:30 last night, that was more or less extinguished, which was excellent. So effectively this morning, we've got a helicopter in the air at the moment. Our fire crews have been there this morning, and it's looking an awful lot better this morning, which is excellent. So hopefully we'll be mopping up this morning. We have another helicopter coming in from Inverness at lunchtime. We've the one working at the moment, and we've a third helicopter hopefully coming down from the Irish Air Corps. So hopefully between the three helicopters and our 3 or 4 ground crews. We should hopefully put everything out today.
That's very positive indeed to hear. And Andrew, I believe you'll be meeting the Coast Guard shortly, and you'll be doing a flyover of the scene around 7:30 to assess the damage. What are you expecting to see, or what will that likely reveal?
Well, certainly last night there was very strong burning. Luckily, the fire, as it came down to the fire crews, as I said, we managed to get rid of a lot of that. So that's associated. So this morning already, talking to the fire crews on the ground this morning, and we've got a lot less smoke this morning, a lot less fire this morning. So it's an awful lot better. So we're hoping it's just going to be more broken up areas rather than large fire lines this morning.
And of course, you're still dealing with the aftermath of the fire itself. But is there any indication as to the cause of the blaze at this stage, or is it too early to say?
It's very hard to know, because when our crews arrived late Friday evening, it was very well established at that stage. It was localized, but very established. But there was very strong wind blowing, kind of funneling through the park. If ever you've been down there, you can imagine, and that was really driving it so fast ahead of them. As we were trying to put it out, it was just gone away from us at that stage. There was so much speed, and the ground was so dry, and very low humidity. And for the last few days, there's been no rain, as you know, low humidity, plenty of sunlight, strong winds. So everything was spreading very, very fast. It just shows something. It might have been something as small as, you know, somebody had a small barbecue or lit a small fire. Something happened, and to think that something small, ignition point like that, when everything is so dry, can just spread so far.
I suppose a subsequent investigation will hopefully determine the cause of the fire. Looking in this morning's newspaper, the front page of the Irish Examiner has a wide shot from above of the devastation. As you say, 2,000 hectares, we believed, already devastated. Our southern editor, Pascal Sheehy, describing the scene yesterday as utter devastation. He said it was lush parkland a few days ago and has been left like a desert. How extensive do we expect the damage to be?
Talking to the park rangers, this wouldn't be my area kind of expertise, but also they were delighted that we did manage to get across with water rescue into the other side of the lake to get in to effectively save, hopefully, the oak trees, which they hope will all recover. And as I say, they're some of the oldest in Ireland, so that was excellent. So, look, at least that's very positive, obviously, the various life forms and various things that the park rangers are concerned about, they will obviously be impacted, but at least, look, my own feeling, at least, that the oaks hopefully will be saved, which I think is a positive thing.
And it's shown the community effort on display down in Kerry. We've had all the various emergency services coming together. You've had fantastic support from the Irish Air Corps. And you've also had private helicopters contracted by the National Parks and Wildlife Service to take part in the firefighting operation. How important has that, I suppose, attack on the fire been from both above and on the ground?
It's been absolutely essential. I'd like to thank the people of Kerry. They've been so good. They've been dropping up sandwiches to our crews and water to our crews and various things. They've been very, very kind. certainly the air support, like at one stage yesterday, once it comes down to us, we've over 100 firefighters in Kerry, and certainly once it comes down to us, they're very used to fighting that type of fire, and they fight it very, very well. But the high-level stuff, really, we're just looking at it at that high. It's just so high up, and the terrain is so bad, you can't drop people up there because it's too steep. So we're really reliant on the air support, and really the private helicopters, together with the Air Corps, without them, you know, things could be a lot worse. And we certainly wouldn't be as good as we are this morning.
Kerry Chief Officer, Fire Officer Andrew McElwraith, thank you very much for that update, and best of luck with the efforts to contain the fire as we continue throughout the day.
It was an unusual ceremony for an unusual movie year. Nomadland won Best Film, Best Director and Best Actress. Anthony Hopkins won Best Actor. No joy for Wolfwalkers from Kilkenny's Cartoon Saloon. Here's Best Actress, Frances McDormand.
They didn't ask me, but if they had, I would have said karaoke, because when you got voices like Leslie and Marcus and, you know, that we should have had a karaoke bar. Okay. I have no words. My voice is in my sword. We know the sword is our work. And I like work. Thank you for knowing that. And thanks for this.
That's Frances McDormand, who won Best Actress at last night's Oscar ceremony. Our arts and media correspondent Sinead Crowley has all the details. Morning, Sinead. Winners first, then tell us about Nomadland.
Yeah, Nomadland, I suppose, was the big winner last night because it got the three big awards, Best Picture, Best Director for Chloe Zhao, and the Best Actress for Frances McDormand. So it was a big winner. Hasn't been seen here yet, but it is going to be on streaming on Disney at the end of the month and then hopefully in cinemas if and when cinemas open later in the summer. But no doubt people will be flocking to see it even on streaming when it opens here because they really are the big awards. And a lot of affection for the film. You know, it stars Frances McDormand, who has lost her job and goes out living in a vehicle, you know, becomes homeless and decides to go on the road in America and meets these other people who style themselves as nomads and decide to live this kind of alternative lifestyle. And some of the actors in the film, some of the people in the film are actually taken from real life. They are people who really do live this life. So it's interesting for a number of reasons.
Usually the award of best film is left until last, but this time it was best actor and he wasn't there. What happened?
Yeah, big shock, as many people are saying. If you were, you know, making this series or this Oscars as a film, you probably wouldn't have ended it like this. But they did decide to end on the best actor. And of course, everybody was expecting that this would go to the late Chadwick Boseman. He's won multiple awards this season for his performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Huge affection for him. He had cancer and died tragically young. So it was expected that he would win. But at the end of the night, it was announced, Joaquin Phoenix announced that the winner was, in fact, Anthony Hopkins, who is 83. He won for The Father, 83, becomes the oldest actor to win, but he wasn't there. So it had been, you know, people had thought maybe the fact that the best actor was at the end was that there could then be a tribute to Chadwick Boseman, but he then didn't win. And Anthony Hopkins wasn't there either and didn't appear by Zoom because there wasn't a Zoom option. There were hubs in various places if you couldn't be at the awards, including in the UK, but Anthony Hopkins wasn't there. So you just ended with, the ceremony just ended really with that announcement of Anthony Hopkins. That's not to take away from, you know, a fantastic performance, but yeah, it certainly wasn't what people were expecting.
Tell us about the other winners of note.
They were kind of spread out, really, which, you know, is interesting. Nomadland obviously got the three, and then Daniel Kaluuya won the Best Supporting Actor. So he was another one. Yoo Joon Yoo, who was the first Korean actor, won as well for Minari. So she gave an acceptance speech that really charmed people. And so they were kind of, other than Nomadland, no major winner like that. Emerald Fennell as well won Best Original Screenplay for Promising Young Woman. Obviously, it's a very different year in that a lot of people haven't seen a lot of the films that are out, especially in, you know, in Ireland. They may start coming out now on streaming services, but it feels very different given the situation with cinemas and so on.
A fifth time nominated, but no joy for Kilkenny.
No, and it's always kind of difficult to put it like that because we do have to remember now that Cartoon Saloon are, you know, they're world players. They are now, they're no longer, I suppose, the small company. They're now the company that continually get nominated for Oscars. And, you know, it's fantastic that they do. At the same time, they were once again up against Pixar, which is, you know, this world-renowned, absolutely massive studio in terms of animation. So they weren't successful. But I suppose what we do need to remember is that, you know, Cartoon Saloon now world players in terms of animation, and they have to be applauded for that.
And that award went to Soul. Is streaming movies the future for Hollywood, or at least a very, very big part of it now?
Well, it's how we're all going to see the films at the moment. At the same time, I think even by watching the ceremony last night, people do miss theatre. The actors and the audience do miss cinema. And yes, you are getting to see the films, but you're not getting that big screen experience. And, you know, films like Mank, which you can see on Netflix, you do miss being in the cinema for them. So it's keeping the industry going. But I certainly get the impression, both from audiences and actors, that they would rather they were back in the cinema. So I suppose the big question now is, when will the cinemas be open and will the audiences go back? Because certainly a lot of these movies are made for the big screen, but at the same time, at least they're still being made, and you know, it has kept going. So I suppose you have to be grateful for that at least.
Very few clips of movies last night at the ceremony. An unusual ceremony, understandable. Did the event work?
I thought it was okay. It had the look of kind of old Hollywood. They produced it, they said, like a film. So you had this you know, small little tables in a room like an old Hollywood nightclub, which I expect is how actually live events are going to be for a while, where you're sitting at a small table with the people you come with and you don't really mingle. And everyone there had been tested. They were masked if they weren't on camera. They were allowed to take off their mask if they were speaking. They had been tested, and it was described as how films are being made at the moment anyway, where you're in small groups and people are being continually tested and so on. So, you know, it was fine. At least they made the effort to put on this live show. I don't think anybody has any patience anymore for long form Zoom ceremonies. It was fine last year when, you know, the pandemic was new, but there was an effort made to put it on, which I think, you know, has to be admired. But absolutely, without the big musical numbers and the huge, big, glamorous red carpet, it's not the same event. So I suppose a lot of people hoping that we will be returning to something like the old style maybe by next year.
Sinead, thank you. That's our arts and media correspondent, Sinead Crowley. You can judge for yourself, of course. RT2 will be showing coverage of the Oscars from 9:35 p.m. Tonight, and that's also on the RTE player.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Now, Darren Frahill, while you and many more were busy pumping footballs and counting cones and bibs over the weekend, there was sport to report on too.
There was, Gavin, and some interesting sport as well. We're going to start at Wembley for a couple of reasons. Firstly, because Manchester City beat Tottenham 1-0 to win the English League Cup. Spurs' 13-year wait for a trophy goes on. Fourth consecutive victory in this competition, though, for City, absolutely dominating it at the moment. But one of the most pleasing sights and sounds from this game was the presence of 8,000 fans at Wembley. Perhaps a little glimmer of better days ahead. Let's hear from the City manager, Pep Guardiola, and this is a welcome sound as well. You can actually hear the fans behind him. Here you go. Here's Pep.
But we played to score. That was important. So we played really well. So today we are incredibly happy for the fact that to win the first title, 4 in a row in this competition, but especially in the last 33 games, we won 30. And this is amazing. In this period, like everyone in lockdown, suffering, you know, different life. And we play with incredible personality to try from the first minute to try to win the game. We create a lot of chances. They had, a few minutes that Lo Celso shoot and some counter-attacks that always are dangerous. But in general, we play a really good final.
Yeah, they're real fans, not pumped in sounds. Makes a real change, doesn't it? Let's hope that is a sign of things to come. Three games in the Premier League yesterday. Leeds and Manchester United played out a scoreless draw. That was the feature game of the day, and a terrible affair, really. Nothing major to report from it. Aston Villa and West Brom played out a 2-2 draw. That's a bit of a blow for West Brom and their hopes to avoid relegation. Burnley 4-0 winners against Wolves, and you think that Burnley are safe now. Aoife Cook is the latest Irish athlete to book a place at the Olympics. She ran under the qualifying time for the marathon yesterday. Aoife's from Cork and she ran 2:28.36 to join Fionnuala McCormack in Tokyo. And another young Irish athlete doing very well was heptathlete Kate O'Connor yesterday. She came second at an event in Italy, and heptathlon, as we know, one of the toughest events with seven different track and field disciplines involved. It was her first time competing in this event for 2 years, and she hasn't lost any of her skills, and coming very close to Olympic qualifying mark. And I think she's going to try and push on now and try and qualify for those games in the summer. Big surprise in the racing yesterday, Vintage Crop Stakes. Victory went to Joseph O'Brien, the trained Baron Samedi, and young jockey, Donegal jockey, Dylan Brown McMonagall on board there. Paul Townend will be fit to take part at the Punchestown Festival tomorrow. Paul and Rachel Blackmore involved in a very tight race to become champion jockey. Now, the season officially comes to an end at this particular meeting. He's recovered from a foot injury and he's been booked to ride three horses on day one tomorrow. It's a mouth-watering prospect for racing journalist Don McLean.
Brilliant that Paul Townend is back. He's been out for 3 weeks since he had that fall off a Gallatin Man at Ferry House. And in that time, Rachel Blackmore has closed the gap on him. She had a treble at Kilbeggan there on Friday night, which narrowed the gap to four. Rachel Blackmore, obviously, she had that unbelievable Cheltenham with six winners and was crowned leading rider and then went on and won the Grand National as well. Like, she's had 91 winners in Ireland, but 8 winners in Britain as well. So she's got 99 winners in both jurisdictions in total. So one more at Punchestown and she reaches the 100 mark. Paul Tannen himself, he's had 3 winners in Britain and 95 in Ireland, including 10 Grade 1 races. So they've both had phenomenal seasons so far. And yeah, it could be a great contest between them now during Punchestown week. You have to say that Paul Tannen is favourite, Darren. Like, he's 4 ahead for starters. And we know that the strength in depth that Willie Mullins has perennially at the Punchestown Festival. I suppose one consideration is that while Willie Mullins wins lots of races, sometimes it's difficult to know with which horse he's going to win which race. Like, he often wins races with a lesser fancy one, and Paul Townend, brilliant rider though he is, he can only ride one horse at every race, so he's going to have some interesting choices to make. There are going to be some really fascinating clashes between Paul Townend and Rachel Blackmore during the week. It was none more so than on the very first day, on the Tuesday, in the Grade 1 3-mile novices chase. Paul Townend and Monkfish and Rachel Blackmore on Envoi Alain. Like, these are two of the best staying novice chasers in the country. Yeah, it's just another dimension that's going to run through the whole week. And yeah, it could be a cracking week ahead.
Yeah, I think it will. Live coverage on RT television and updates throughout the day on RT Radio 1. Finally, Mark Allen, hanging on in his last 16 World Championship match against Mark Selby, trails 9-6, first to 13 wins. That match resumes later this evening.
The number of people allowed to attend funerals increases from 10 to 25 today. The grief of losing a loved one during the pandemic has been exacerbated by travel restrictions and the numbers of mourners allowed to attend. But Petula Martin has been finding out how the live streaming of funerals has been a source of comfort to the bereaved.
Everyone in the area knew Jim. Big Jim was his nickname, you know. And it was lovely, you know, throughout his life to see just the friendship that he had with everyone in the area and everyone in the city, really, you know. And it was just, I think it was a... Yeah, I think he was just a well-liked man.
Dermot O'Mahony's father, Jim, died on April 20th last year. He was a father of 5, a brother of 10, and a friend to many in his native Limerick. His family was faced with deciding who should attend his funeral. Dermot made inquiries, and his father's funeral was one of the first to be live-streamed online.
All his family around the world, his brothers, all these people who really wanted to attend, all of a sudden, everyone can be involved. And that was just such a comfort, I think.
It was a source of comfort, too, that Dermot's mother, Noreen, could watch the funeral from her nursing home.
Whoever's with my mother now, could you just hold her hand and just, ma'am, dad, he cherished you. And we're really sorry you can't be here with us. But we love you. And as soon as all this ends, we'll make sure that we celebrate his life with you.
We're privileged, really, even though we might know the people. And in most cases, we don't know the people. But it is still a privilege to actually be at this person's funeral. And that's how we treat it. And we take, I suppose, great responsibility in making sure that the stream goes extremely well.
David O'Shea is managing director of live streaming company Entree.
We are, and we would have been, a sports live streaming company. So we'd have done a lot of stuff with the likes of athletics, the Camogie Association, Swim Ireland, Hockey Ireland, those type of events. So if you think of a lot of the events that would be just below TV, they would have been the events we'd have covered, and we'd have streamed them then to either the sponsors or to the organisation's YouTube or Facebook channel. And that's what we were doing.
When the pandemic hit, there was no sport to cover, but there was a need for people to be able to attend funerals online.
So we'll go to the church before the funeral. We do a site test, making sure that we're going to have a successful stream. And then we set up a link then, and it's what's called an unlisted link. So it's a link that only people with the link are able to view. So it's not, you're not able to just search for this person's funeral. The family have to send it to you, or it can be put on the death notice on RIP.ie or various websites. Once people have that link then, they click in and they can actually watch the funeral mass or the funeral service.
Griffin's is a 6th generation family owned funeral business in Limerick, which has been passed from father to son since 1860. John Mark Griffin is managing director. He says it was rare for a family to request for a funeral to be streamed online before COVID-19.
I'd pretty much say 95% of funerals that have taken place since the pandemic has started have been streamed. Only cases where family are quite small and able to fit in with the numbers within the church, or if it was a case where people were very private and didn't want to share the the scenario would that not happen. But other than that, it pretty much has been nearly every family, really, to be honest with you, yeah.
Are there examples of families who haven't been able to attend the funeral of a loved one and relied completely on live streaming of funerals?
Yes, absolutely. There has been examples of this. It's been extremely difficult for the families to not be able to attend their own family members' funerals. But we do feel that the stream did help them a little bit, but it definitely didn't replace the feeling of them being there.
You obviously have a sense of it every time that it's so important to people. But that day, you know, 10 minutes before the stream started, you're getting a message from the son who's over in Australia, and you just know the requirement for this to go extremely well.
Do you think there'll still be demand for this post-pandemic?
It'll be a service that'll be there for maybe extended family members or for family friends that are living abroad that will be able to want it. People now know about it, but the demand for it will certainly go down once the restrictions in terms of mourners allowed into the church and the travel restrictions are eased.
David O'Shea from Entrée, ending that report from Petula Martin.
Will a four-day boycott of social media by footballers, their clubs, leagues and organisations in Britain make any difference to racism in the sport? The strike from this Friday until next Monday, where high-profile footballers will turn off their Twitter, Facebook and Instagram accounts for the weekend, is in response to increasing reports of abuse online. The Manchester United manager Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was asked about the social media ban after yesterday's Premier League match with Leeds.
There's no doubt it's needed. It's needed that action is taken and that it stops, full stop. Of course, we want to play our part, and this is our part to play, and hopefully this will be the end of it.
A joint statement from English football's governing body said the boycott is a way to emphasise that social media companies must do more to eradicate online hate, while also highlighting the importance of educating people. Let's speak to Ken McHugh. He's cultural officer here with Sport Against Racism Ireland. Ken McHugh, good morning.
How are you?
Tell us more about why this strike is happening at this time.
Well, I think at this stage, the players, the footballers, particularly the high-profile ones, are just fed up with the lack of response from the social media platforms. And they decided to take action. Now, that includes 4,000 members of the PFA, the Professional Footballers Association, all across the UK. And, you know, I think it's a very powerful statement. Like, we've been working, Sport Against Racism, been working through the Network Against Racism here to try and get the Facebook to take down, before they go up on the platforms, to actually filter the hate speech. See, when it's too late, when you have to take it down because you have to report it and the damage is done then, you know.
We reported recently here on the experience of Irish footballers in Britain, including Callum Robinson and James McLean. Yeah. Can you give us some more examples?
Oh, there's lots of examples. Yeah, it's not just in the high-profile players. We get reports of players being abused here right across the board. This all came to a head recently with the killing of George Nkencho. When the alt-right obviously had an orchestrated campaign of hate and character assassination of the young lad. And again, the damage was done because it was impossible to take everything down at that stage. Now, individual players like Thierry Henry have taken action. And Thierry Henry is a big influence in the FIPRO organisation, which has 65,000 players. That's the global trade union movement for the players, with players like Messi and Ronaldo. So, Facebook will say that they are working on a filtering or a shielding system, but I haven't seen evidence of that, to be honest.
There isn't a strike here. Can you tell me about the level of online abuse that players suffer here, Ken?
Yeah, we get, as I said, Sarri gets regular reports of players, like, not just it's the amateur game as well. It's not just the pro game. And it's like to use the football term, the injury term, the Achilles heel, is that we don't have hate speech legislation. So it's open season for the alt-right who orchestrate these campaigns against the players. We've been asking Facebook to engage with Sarri in their football versus discrimination education program in schools, because that's where it starts. And we have to deal with unconscious bias. Because after the George Nkencho, that horrific hate speech campaign they had, the alt-right, we've been asking Facebook to engage with us in the to look at unconscious bias and anti-racism in schools, because, as I said, it starts there.
Do you think this strike will make any difference?
It will, absolutely. This is a huge impact on Facebook. Like, the high profile of these players, you know, these are big accounts, what they call accounts. And then if it extends, that's only phase one. Phase two will be the, if it's not sorted, it'll be the FIPRO strike, which they have 65,000 members. Like, the magazine, if you look at that magazine, it's got ads for Ferrari in them, you know. Like, these are big, this is big money, you know, and Facebook don't reply to it or attempt to do something about it. They're in serious trouble.
Ken McHugh, Cultural Officer with Sport Against Racism Ireland, thank you for speaking to us on the programme.
The rate of price growth in commercial construction eased last year, falling by close to two-thirds when compared to pre-COVID levels. That's according to a survey of tender prices by the Society of Chartered Surveyors Ireland, which was conducted in February. Micheál Mahon is President of the SCSI. He joins me on the line now. Micheál, is this slowdown in construction price inflation entirely due to the fact that much of the sector was halted for a lot of last year?
Morning, Adam. Yes, that's certainly a huge factor in it. This is a report we issue twice a year, tracking the movement in tender prices of commercial projects across the country. And for the year 2020, as you say, our first COVID year, the inflation on average was of the order of 2.2%. So, yes, we are putting it down to the fact that the industry was closed and there has been a huge drop-off in certain sectors of the industry, such as hotel, retail, perhaps, and offices to a degree in terms of demand for construction services. But with regard to future forecasting, we're in a very strange position now as well, and a difficult position in terms of forecasting future tender prices because of a lot of issues, including not least COVID and Brexit. But given what we're seeing to date in this quarter, we are currently predicting a 1% to 2% increase on the first half of 2021. But Adam, this comes with a serious, serious health warning in that the industry has been closed. And, you know, we have been advocating for a full reopening of the construction sector. But critically, what also must happen is that we have a reopening of the property sector to facilitate viewings and transactions in sales and rentals, which hopefully then will help increase supply back into the market and indeed fund the reopened construction sector.
Indications that there will be a full reopening of the construction sector from next week. But we did also see last week a COVID outbreak connected to the Intel site in Leixlip. Is the sector actually safe enough to return in full at the moment?
The answer is a caveated yes. I have to say, Adam, if you look at the previous time the sector was open in 2020, its record was exemplary. It does appear, looking at the stats for this year as well, that particular case you quote appears to have been a one-off. If we track all the other projects, it's one of thousands of projects that are underway. But look, the sector has to remain vigilant. It has serious protocols in place, but our view still is, yes, that it is safe to reopen.
Another issue that may be facing the sector is skills. Last week we had a report by TASC and the Chartered Institute of Builders warning of labour shortages. Yesterday the Sunday Independent reported on UK building firms poaching Irish workers. Is the sector actually ready for a full reopening in terms of staffing?
Well, Adam, that's exactly back to my point in terms of future forecasting, because we've a couple of different dynamics here. We have a fall off in demand for our services in certain sectors, as I've outlined, hotel, retail, and perhaps offices, and a couple of other sectors. But on the other side of the dynamic is we have a lot of potential increases in materials that are coming down the line, such as steel and timber, and also potentially labour shortages. And it is a real threat. So that's what I say, we're in a very kind of volatile situation at the moment, and how this plays out as the sector reopens in the next few months, we will see then the full impact and the full impact on tender prices.
You mentioned looking for the property market to be fully reopened as well. Is that really necessary? It's been actually quite buoyant in the last few months. You see prices up in February, sales volumes up as well. So it's doing quite well despite the restrictions.
Yeah, well, I suppose, Adam, I saw a report the weekend as well, but talking about the activity for the first quarter of 2021. But as you know, Adam, concluding of commercial or property transactions takes two to three months. So without having seen the actual granular detail of those reports, we do suspect that a lot of that activity relates to pre-Christmas when the property sector still was open for viewings, etc. So, and that would then, the conclusion of those transactions would happen in the first quarter of this year.
Okay, Micheál Mahon, President of the SCSI, thank you very much for that.
Troika-style spending curbs to return is the Irish Examiner's main front-page headline this morning, with detail that budget controls have been slapped on the biggest departments, including health, education and social protection. As we've been hearing, Daniel McConnell writes that this is all as part of a need to cut an estimated $12 billion from state spending, as Public Expenditure Minister Michael McGrath seeks to wean the country off emergency COVID-19 spending. The Irish Daily Mail leads on Don't Mess It Up Now, above the story that Taoiseach Micheál Martin is urging the public to hang tight and stick with restrictions for another while longer to ensure the nation isn't hit with a new wave of COVID-19 and a fresh lockdown. And that theme is on the front of the Irish Times too this morning, with Jennifer Bray writing that the government will resist pressure to accelerate the planned summer reopening of the country amid concerns about a potential spike in COVID-19 infections. The appeal yesterday from publicans for beer gardens to be reopened from May 24th is on the front of the Irish Daily Mirror, with the headline, "Keeping us shut is pointless." The death outside Garrettstown, County Cork, at the weekend of 22-year-old Conor King is covered on the front of the Irish Sun, the Mail and the Irish Daily Star, and features across the papers this morning. The young man died after falling down a cliff blowhole near the old head of Kinsale. The Irish Independent's lead story is that the government is planning to allow up to 50 people at mass and regular religious services from mid-May, but not at funerals and weddings. From today, 25 people can attend a funeral and weddings remain at 6 guests. Senna Maloney writes that senior government sources accepted last night that such a decision may lead to accusations of mixed messages. A source close to the Taoiseach is quoted as saying that the difference is that people go home after an ordinary mass or service or ceremony in other faiths. Mass confusion is the headline there. The Irish Times and The Examiner have detail of Flourish, the new relationship and sexual education programme, or RSE, for Catholic primary schools developed by the Irish Bishops Conference. Writing in The Examiner, Jess Casey details how strands and themes for the programme in senior classes will teach that sex is a gift from God, puberty is a gift from God, sexual love belongs in a committed relationship, and marriage is a sacrament of commitment. An introductory document for the programme says that RSE must be taught with reference to moral decision-making and that teachers must be sensitive to the family circumstances of the children in their care. The introduction also says the same moral obligation to respect and treat our bodies with dignity applies to people of all sexual orientation. However, the Church's teaching in relation to marriage between a man and a woman cannot be omitted. Conla Young in the Irish News writes that a group of high-profile political, policing and religious figures have penned an open letter to the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, urging him to act in the wake of recent loyalist violence. Signatories include former Secretaries of State Peter Mandelson, Peter Hain, Paul Murphy and Sean Woodward, former PSNI Chief Constable Hugh Ord and former Archbishop Robin Eames. The question of reopening is on the mind of the Irish Independent's leader writer this morning. That paper carries an editorial which cautions against reopening too fast and urges us to ponder the perils of an ill-judged easing of virus restrictions. And elsewhere on that page, Tom Gilsonen of Beaumont in Dublin writes a letter to the editor saying, "How lucky I am that I can actually walk to my holiday home. That garden shed has turned out to be a great investment."
As we've been hearing, efforts to put out huge fires in Killarney National Park in Kerry, which have been burning since Friday night, continue this morning. Around a third of the national park has been burnt as a result of the wildfires. Earlier, Chief Fire Officer Andrew McElraith told us that just one high-level fire remains in the east ridge of Pepper Mountain. Last night, Rory Hodd, an ecologist and botanist living in the Killarney area, spoke with our reporter Amy Nereida about the immediate loss of wildlife and vegetation as a result of the blazes.
The main two kind of habitats there in the first place are heath habitats, so wet heath and dry heath, and then the old Atlantic oak woodlands. In terms of wildlife, there would be lots of deer in that area, lizards, birds, a lot of nesting birds this time of year as well, so it's likely that a lot of bird nests would have been lost and a lot of other animals would have been killed because they would have really been, you know, they wouldn't have had time to escape to other parts before the fire came in. some kind of vegetation will come back very quickly, but you know, it won't necessarily be the vegetation that was there originally. And if the vegetation that comes back is highly modified, degraded, you lose a lot of species that won't come back in. And also the vegetation that often comes back in, particularly in the heath areas, actually is more flowable. So we need to bring in legislation to make, you know, tougher penalties for burning, particularly out of season. And I was, you know, up in that area now just a few months ago doing some work, and just to see, yeah, to see the damage and the loss, and it's quite devastating really to see that.
Killarney-based ecologist and botanist Rory Hodd there. I'm joined now by Minister of State for Heritage Malcolm Noonan, who will be on his way shortly to Killarney National Park. Good morning, Minister.
Good morning, Angus.
Rory Hodd, as you heard, calling for tougher penalties for setting illegal wildfires, which we know are a problem at this time of year. To be clear, we don't know the cause of the Killarney National Park fire at this stage, but is that part of the line of inquiry for the investigation?
Yeah, certainly when we look at this in a week or so's time, we certainly have to consider that. I mean, this is absolutely devastating for our national park, and we have fires blazing in Mayo, in the Mournes, in the Blackstairs. And as Rory has said there, it's really devastating to insects, to ground nesting birds, mammals, water quality, and also not to mention the carbon emissions. So we do have to consider this, and we have to consider looking at rewarding good practice, and particularly with the next CAP strategic plan, that we have to give in these talks, to give consideration to rewarding the value, the biodiversity value for heather and scrub and these type of habitats. I think that's really important. But the immediate challenge now is to bring the fire under control and to deal with that. And I think our teams are working really, really hard on the ground over the last number of days to try and contain this fire.
As you highlight there yourself, emergency services across the country dealing with a number of gorse fires across the country. Are tougher penalties needed, do you think, or could they be part of the solution to this to help enforcement when it comes to wildfires?
There's no doubt about that, and there have to be consequences for people who set these fires. They're not a natural phenomenon across the country, and I think that's critical, again, as I said, in relation to whether it be, in this case, it could be recreational, it could be non-agriculture related. But if they are agriculture related, I think there need to be consequences there for people who set these fires deliberately. In terms of our response, I'm delighted to be able to, we have a current intake of wildlife rangers. We were due to take in 25. We will be doubling that to 50, and I think that's going to be an important additional resource of boots on the ground for rangers to work on the ground with this.
In addition, you're also working with government colleagues on an emergency multi-departmental response to the situation. Beyond additional rangers, what does that response involve at this point?
I think a number of things. The agriculture issue we've mentioned, and I think the CAP strategic plan is going to be critical. But we also need to look at staycationing. The Taoiseach has said this is going to be the summer of the outdoor activity. And I think we need to have a coordinated action across government around messaging, around the use of our nature reserves, our national parks, and the responsible use of those by the public. Secondly, I think we need to look at roles. We're very grateful for the support of the Air Corps over the last number of days. But I think particularly when we're stretched where there are multiple fires across the country, we do need to look at a future enhanced role for the Defence Forces. And that's something I will be speaking to the Minister for Defence on in relation specifically to the Commission on the Future of the Defence Forces. Where are the opportunities that lie around developing and embedding climate resilience into our system and ensuring that we have quick, rapid responses to incidences, particularly, as I said, where there are multiple fires raging across the country?
Kerry's Mayor Patrick O'Connor Scarthine has said that in the coming weeks and indeed months, a great community approach may be needed to help repair and restore the park after this devastating fire. You mentioned an increased role for the Defence Forces. What sort of support is the government likely to offer in this regard? Are we likely to see soldiers roaming around the mountains, for example?
Well, we look at other jurisdictions, and in France, the Defence Forces have a role in actually, and our trained Defence Forces personnel are trained in going out and managing these fires. As I said, I'm delighted with the support of Taoiseach and my colleague, Minister O'Brien, to be able to increase the ranger intake to 50, which I think is badly needed. So that's a good response in terms of that. But I think the wider issue around that, around the use of communities. The metal has been a fantastic resource in Killarney, and I do think that when we debrief and look at the myriad of issues around the last couple of days, how we respond in a strategic and a coordinated way is going to be vital, because these instances are going to continue. Aside of the issues of deliberate and indiscriminate burning out of season, there we are looking at a changed climate, and I think right across the world we're seeing fires like this raging, and that I think it's really important that the state, the government, has that resilience built into the system to manage them.
And in the immediate aftermath of the fire, of course, it's dealing with the fire, the safety protocols, restoring the situation as best as possible. But a big part of that is going to be the environmental impact. We're right in the middle of nesting season. We're in the middle of calving season for deer. We know that one of the fires yesterday, they managed to put out, saving a place called Oak Wood, home to some of the oldest oaks in the country. But the environmental loss and impact, that's going to have to be assessed and addressed for some time to come.
It is, and certainly, there's no doubt there's a hen harrier nesting site that's destroyed, as far as I understand it. Also, it's a really important habitat to ground nesting birds. We're relieved and fortunate that the ancient woodlands have been saved, and certainly they managed to minimise damage to Tomy's Wood and other areas within the park. But I think over the next number of days, and once the fire is brought under control, we can have a detailed consideration of the environmental impact. And it goes beyond the what's physically visible, because it's damage to water quality, to soils, destabilisation of soils. So it has a really deep and residual impact over many, many years.
Minister of State for Heritage Malcolm Noonan speaking with me a short time ago in relation to those wildfires in Killarney National Park, which it's hoped will be extinguished by the end of today.
Gardaí could soon be wearing body cameras under laws to be put forward by the government this week. The Garda Síochána Digital Recording Bill will also give the Gardaí new powers to use phones, camcorders, laptops and drones while they're doing their job. Liam Herrick is Executive Director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties and is with us now. Liam Herrick, good morning.
Good morning, Gavin.
Department of Justice say the cameras will be used for preventing, investigating, detecting or prosecuting criminal offences, securing public order and public safety, or safeguarding against and the prevention of threats to public security. Now, Gardaí have been asking for body cams for years, and their use was recommended by the Commission on the Future of Policing 2.5 years ago. You're not in favour. Why?
No, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties engage in the consultation with the department on this proposal, and our analysis by looking at the new research emerging, particularly in the United States, is that some of the reasons why countries like the United States originally opted for this technology, which was to improve police behaviour, improve the detection of crime and give an accurate record of incidents, that whereas there was early research in the early part of the last decade which said that there were benefits in this technology, more recent research has actually debunked that. And what we're seeing now is this is an expensive technology which changes the relationship between the police and the public. And in fact, it doesn't seem to have that effect on improving police behaviour, reducing complaints, increasing the prosecution of crime. And really, I think when you look at larger pools of data, what you're seeing is that police officers in the small minority of cases who are intent on breaking the law, for example, can direct cameras away or can stop them operating for periods of time. And on the other hand, it does cause a level of intimidation and change the power relationship between the police and the public. So we think that the broader pool of research is actually suggesting that the benefits aren't quite as much as was originally hoped.
Gardaí say they believe it can protect them from malicious allegations of abuse, and you've mentioned that. Do you accept that there is any legitimate basis for their use?
No, I mean, we can see why there's an attraction to this, but those benefits don't seem to be materialised. And I think a lot of this is down to a number of early research projects in 2010, 11 and 12, particularly in California, where it did suggest that there were a lot of benefits. In that small pool research in California, what you were seeing is that there seemed to be a reduction in complaints and also a reduction in police use of excessive force. But more recent, larger pool research actually debunks that. And we need to think here, I suppose, about the relationship between the police and the public. If we go down the road of United States cities and indeed in the United Kingdom, where you give more and more technology, more and more equipment to the police in terms of their community-facing role, that it alters that relationship. And we have an unarmed police force here. We have a community policing model. And I think this type of high technology policing in terms of on-the-beat policing is not the direction that we want to go. And I think that the cost won't be justified by the purported benefits from this tech.
The Department of Justice, and you mentioned this, also say that they engaged extensively with organisations, including yours. Have any of your concerns been taken on board?
Well, we'll need to see what detail emerges tomorrow. I think what is very positive is that the minister is indicating that she wants to overhaul the entire legal regime for surveillance by police more generally. And Ireland has been found in violation of European law in terms of the weakness of our statutory regime around surveillance generally over a number of years. There is new technology emerging all the time with greater capacity in things like facial recognition technology, smart technology and so on, yes. The use of drones. So the fact that the minister is intending to publish legislation and have a national debate on this, and she's indicating she wants to take time to do this, is very, very positive. But we are at a crucial point here. There's technology emerging now, particularly in relation to areas like facial recognition technology, automated number recognition, number plate recognition, that has huge potential for crime detection, but also has huge potential, if used too broadly, for a type of mass surveillance. Yes. And getting that balance right between a narrow focused use and excessive use is difficult.
Yes, you mentioned there are other aspects to this bill, widening out the use of digital technologies. You mentioned Gardaí, for example, accessing third-party CCTV on a live feed basis, and as you mentioned, that automated number plate recognition data from other organisations' cameras. Do you see a use for them?
I think the technology is there and can be a tool. But the clear distinction here that we need to have is that, for example, at the moment, the police can access CCTV if they have a warrant, if there's a specific criminal investigation ongoing to source that information. The other end of the spectrum is where we see jurisdictions moving towards mass surveillance so that the police can at will surveil and track where members of the public might be. We've seen some instances where certain sections of the population become over-surveilled and over-policed. And these are the kind of dangers we need to guard against. If we look at where the European Union is on this at the moment, it is recognising that certain technology, particularly facial recognition technology, carries real dangers, and it's introducing a ban on facial recognition technology in terms of CCTV. Cities like San Francisco are doing the same. So this is an international debate, and I think it's very timely that we're having that debate here now. Some technology can certainly help. Others, I think, will carry greater dangers of surveillance than they will have a criminal justice function.
Liam Herrick, thank you for speaking to us. Liam Herrick is Executive Director of the Irish Council for Civil Liberties.
Today marks the 35th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster, when a misguided electrical test at the nuclear plant in northern Ukraine triggered a power surge that culminated in two explosions. In what's regarded as the world's worst nuclear disaster, radiation contamination still plagues areas of northern Ukraine, southern Belarus and western Russia today. Our correspondent Paul Cunningham visited the Chernobyl plant 15 years ago, along with cameraman Ken Fogarty. In this report, he looks back on that assignment and the legacy of Chernobyl.
The first day I worked there, I got a high radiation dose. I came back in the evening and my wife said, my t-shirt immediately light.
Valentin Masalyuk was a liquidator, one of more than 500,000 people involved in the cleanup efforts at Chernobyl. When I met Valentin, he was being treated for cancer.
Practically everyone is sick. Many of my friends have already died. They seem to be healthy, and then you hear they died. Why?
Many of the people I met in 2006 were ill. That included Colonel Oleg Chichkov, who flew choppers over the burning nuclear plant. For 10 days he dropped lead, dolomite, boric acid, cement and earth into the exposed reactor core. For him, orders were orders.
People knew what the atom was. We were given an order. I was a military pilot. I understood my responsibility as a senior officer. We had to do it as soon as possible, and well.
But others, like firefighter Viktor Petrukhno, tell me they were not given appropriate protection.
We extinguished fires without any personal protection. We had no respirators, no gas masks, no special clothes. We had nothing.
People living nearby were not told of the dangers immediately either. Ivan Mozichenko was one of those unknowingly exposed to radiation.
Immediately after the explosion, we felt a bitter taste in our mouth. Back then, we didn't know why. You would come home to eat and you would feel bitterness.
After a few days, nearby areas were evacuated. Some people refused to leave their remote villages, others returned after unhappy experiences of living in cities. People like Nadia Petrukhno.
Well, we hope that it's okay to eat them. We eat everything that we grow in our garden, onions, potatoes, carrots, beetroots. People have been living here for many years.
Chernobyl triggered psychological as well as physical damage. Vladimir Kozelyev told me when his mother died, his father simply gave up.
My father was supposed to have a blood transfusion. He was sick. He refused to do it. He said he didn't want to live any longer and to bury him in the village.
One area of agreement I found was the warmth of the affection in southern Belarus for Irish help through Chernobyl Children International. It's not just the more than 100 million euro in aid or the 25,000 children from the wider Chernobyl area travelled to Ireland for rest and recuperation, but also life-saving cardiac surgery. In 2006, I met Vitaly, who was a 9-year-old boy 12 years previously, had pleaded to Chernobyl Children International founder Eddie Roach from his hospital bed to save him from a heart condition caused by radioactive cesium.
You shouted out in Russian, please take me to your country.
Yeah.
I will die.
I remember that all the time. Yeah.
Vitaly and a younger child, Sasha, became the first children from Belarus to travel to Ireland for medical treatment.
In the Belarusian, lots of snow. I'm going to Ireland, it's amazing. It's just only raining, no snow, green grass. It's, I don't know, amazing.
The other child, Sasha, told me how that life-saving operation in Ireland determined his future.
I tried to go to university to be a doctor.
Why do you want to become a doctor?
Because doctors saved my life. So I want to be saved the lives as well.
On this, the 35th anniversary, I asked Adi Roach what her priorities were so many years after disaster struck at Chernobyl.
We've been honoured today by the President of Ireland in recognising the pioneering work that Ireland has done. We're acknowledging the volunteerism of Ireland today. And of course, in the opposite direction, we are sending this wonderful lifeline to the victims and survivors. And with a global voice led by the President of Ireland, we are saying clearly to the victims and survivors, we will not forget you.
And that was Adi Roach, volunteer CEO of Chernobyl Children International. If you want to learn more about Chernobyl, Paul has a blog posted on the RTE News website, where there is also information about the global candle lighting event, which is being led by President Michael D. Higgins.
RTE Radio 1 Sport with Kia. Going electric? Plug into the new Kia Ceed SW plug-in hybrid.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
Now at 24 minutes to 9, we can join Darren Frettel with this morning's sports news.
Thank you, Angus. A very significant day for many children, the length and breadth of the country who play sport. From today, those who participate in outdoor sports can return to action in small pods. Now, it's another very important step on the road out of this pandemic. All sporting organisations have been advising their coaches how to handle this return. It's potentially a tough return for some young kids. I've been talking to an expert in this field. Des Ryan is head of sports medicine and athletic development at Arsenal Football Club. Des has been supporting the GAA with their programme, and he has this advice for parents and coaches.
Exciting time for everybody, players, parents, coaches. Luckily enough, we're down the road in Arsenal Academy here with the under-9s to under-16s. They're back a good few weeks. We're playing matches, etc. And the key to it is gradual. The key to it is easing in. We did one session week one, two sessions week two, three sessions week three, and an adapted match. We gradually eased in, along with work at home. And if I was to use a phrase, it would be leave the players wanting more for the first 2 weeks. And whatever you did prior to lockdown in a normal training week, don't do the same, do less. And gradually, as the weeks go by, build up. I would point people towards, there's a huge amount of information from the GAA. There's a Be Ready to Play on the GAA website, GAA Learning. They've been inactive for a long time. They may not have been out in big areas sprinting, running. They may not have been kicking the ball as far, a lot of activity in back gardens, etc. So that's got to be reintroduced carefully and planned. So an emphasis on coaches to plan, but plenty of tips, suggestions, guidelines on the GA website.
It's certain that some children, they will not want to return. A year is a long time for any child. I know there was a brief return last year. But have you any advice for parents whose children won't go back, do not want to go back?
Very important to get all the children of Ireland back active and enjoying what they're doing. And if there is young people there that are hesitant, don't really want to go back, I think a key strategy for parents and for coaches is just to ask the children, what would they like to do? Listen to their suggestions. And if the young people know that they're going into a session where they have built it, they know what's coming and they know it's stuff they like to do, well, then they'll be more inclined to head back and look forward to it with good energy. For example, my niece, when I ask her what she likes about Gaelic games training, she likes running around crazy and having fun with her friends. So that should be allowed. That should be part of the session. The things children like to do. It should be a fun environment. It should be a child-friendly environment. Why not let the children decide what happens in a part of the session? And that will help them stay coming. And the ones that may be a little bit hesitant to go on, they'll be looking forward to the session because they would have contributed to it. The other challenging aspect after such a long period of time with low activity levels is the older children going into adolescent. There will be big changes for boys and girls from the last time the coaches have seen the players. Some of them may have gone through a rapid growth spurt, and that's got to be monitored closely. It doesn't mean that it's a normal process. It doesn't mean that they have to stop partaking in sport, but listen to them again. Is there pain in their knees? So if there's symptoms, maybe 2 out of 10 pain, maybe they do a bit less. They go see a medical practitioner. If the pain is 5 or above, maybe that session isn't a session to do and they're rested and again see a medical practitioner.
Yeah, some great advice there from Des Ryan, and he has been working with some of the finest young talent in the UK for the last 8 years, but is returning home later this year after some great work there with Arsenal Football Club. I hope that is of some use to you this morning, and good luck to all the children heading back to their training sessions this week. I'm looking forward to it, certainly. Manchester City beat Tottenham 1-0 to win the English League Cup. Spurs, 13-year wait for a trophy goes on, but for City, this is a fourth consecutive victory in the competition. And what was great to see yesterday was the sight of 8,000 fans at Wembley, and they certainly made their voice heard as well yesterday. Leeds and Manchester United played out a scoreless draw in the Premier League. Not that it was ever in doubt, but I think that result pretty much puts the league title beyond Manchester United's ability at this stage. I think two more wins will get City over the line. Aston Villa and West Brom played out a 2-2 draw. Burnley, 4-0 winners against Wolves. Great news for Aoife Cook. She is the latest Irish athlete to book a place at the Olympics. She ran under the qualifying time for the marathon. She's from Cork. She ran 2:28.36, and she'll join Fionnuala McCormack in Tokyo. Another athlete doing really well over the weekend was heptathlete Kate O'Connor, second at an event in Italy yesterday. She clocked up 6,297 points. It's a new Irish record for this discipline, and now she'll be setting her sights on Olympic qualification. The mark she has to reach is 6,420 points. Big surprise in the Vintage Crop Stakes yesterday, as Joseph O'Brien's trained Baron Samedi won the big race at Navan. The highlight of the story for me is that the horse was ridden by a young jockey from Donegal, Dylan Brown McMonagall. He's only 19. This was his first group winner in his very first group ride, and he's been telling Brendan McArdle about some of the challenges he's overcome to be on that horse yesterday.
Delighted, he did it really well. Got a lovely run round. He travelled well into the straight, and in fairness to him, he picked up well once I got after him, and he dug deep in the last furlong, but he's a horse there's no bottom to, and I'm just delighted to be able to ride him.
Now, we all know you from the pony racing days and then getting forward to this particular level, but last year at the end, you had a bad accident and you broke a lot of bones. What happened to you?
I had a car crash just before Christmas and I broke a few bones and was out for a bit of the winter series, but I got back again then a couple of weeks left of the flat season, got a few winners, and thankfully I'm going well so far, so hopefully I can keep up.
You're enjoying this game?
Yeah, I love it, sure. This is what the big days like this is what it all means for, and sure, I'm just delighted when all the hard work pays off.
Yeah, well done to him. I know the jockey, Paul Townend, will be fit to take part at the Punchestown Festival, which gets underway tomorrow. And finally, Mark Allen, hanging in there in the last 16 at the World Championship against Mark Selby, trails 9-6, first to 13 wins. That match resumes tonight. That's all your sport for now.
India reported almost 350,000 more cases in the 24 hours to yesterday morning and another 2,767 deaths. However, the true figures are thought to be much higher. Dr. Harshit Singh Bhatti works at the Manipal Hospital in Delhi. He's been describing what conditions are like there.
We are not able to provide oxygen to the patients and they are dying. Like, means I don't want to compare, but the situation is like, have you seen the fish out of water? The situation is same as the people who are dying, struggling for oxygen. They were not getting oxygen and they are dying on roads. Many of our patients need ventilator. Many of the patients need high flow oxygen. But because another patient is on the bed and they are on ventilator, so we are not able to provide ventilator to other patients. It is when I am inside my high dependency unit, that is HDU. So we are in a dual mindset. There, when one patient expires, we don't have a time to grieve for them. We don't have a time to cry for them. We just have to wrap up their body and just clean the bed and put another patient on that bed with the ventilator. So that's why I have written on my social media also that we are now, our mental status is like that we are feeling a dual sort of emotions. One, grief for my lost patient, and a relief for my another patient which is gasping for breaths, and we are putting them on ventilator in a hope that they might survive and we can save one patient.
That's Dr. Harshit Singh Bhatti at the Manipal Hospital in Delhi. Let's speak to Rahul Bedi. He's the Irish Times correspondent based in New Delhi. Rahul Bedi, good morning. Thanks for taking our call today.
Good morning.
The footage from India viewing is very difficult, particularly for families here, for people here who have families in India. Can you describe what conditions are like there at the moment?
Well, as the doctor said, the situation is really apocalyptical. I mean, the people are waiting in queues outside hospitals. A lot of them are being turned away. And the grimmer side of the situation is really that cremations are being carried out in public parks, in parking lots. People are being buried in public parks because the graveyards are overflowing. There's a waiting list for cremation grounds. And as the doctor said, people are struggling for oxygen. A lot of the hospitals all over the country, in fact, have oxygen reserves of no more than 2 or 3 hours. And scores of people are dying by the hour because they just do not have either oxygen or the ability to get into any hospital.
What is India going to do?
Well, the government is trying desperately. I mean, the government is really responsible for this catastrophe, because it's a combination really of hubris of Mr. Modi's government, which in February and March had declared that they'd seen the end of the COVID and that India had battled COVID in a remarkable manner, and they did not anticipate a second wave which was staring them really in the face. And they're now desperately scrambling around for oxygen from Russia, from Germany, from Europe, from the United States. The Indian Air Force has been deployed to send its transport aircraft to get oxygen plants. And hopefully something would work out by the end of the week. But in the meantime, there are hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of patients who are likely to die.
Rahul, thank you for talking to us. That's Rahul Bedi, Irish Times correspondent in New Delhi. From today, you can play golf, tennis, go to the zoo, and if you're under 18, meet your friends to play organised sport for the first time in almost 5 months. The deaths of 6 more people with COVID-19 were reported over the weekend here, and from today, the number of people who can attend a funeral goes up to 25. As the spread of the virus continues to slow and more people get a vaccine to protect them from getting sick from COVID, the government is expected on Thursday to set out plans to lift more restrictions for May, which starts on Saturday, and the rest of the summer. Let's talk to Daniel McConnell, political editor at the Irish Examiner. Morning, Daniel. What else is opening today?
Yeah, so as you rightly said, so this is the third of four phases announced by government in terms of the reopening or the slow reopening of the country across April and May. So today, as you said, outdoor sports facilities will reopen. That's your pitches, your golf courses, your tennis courts and other facilities as they deem appropriate. Outdoor attractions, including your zoos, your petting farms, your heritage sites will all reopen. Amusement parks, however, are not included in that particular list. And as you said, underage non-contact sport for underage children in pods of up to 15 can start, and that's obviously very important, that, you know, Gaelic and soccer and rugby training, etc., like that will begin. So you'll see a lot of clubs all over the country kick into gear in a way that they haven't done since before Christmas today. And the other major feature for today is the maximum attendance of funerals will increase to 25. Now, as I said, that's the third or fourth phase. They've obviously set out what they're likely to do from May 4th, and that's obviously going to be part of the major announcement that's coming from government later today. But we already know some of what's going to be announced. Obviously, there's expected a full reopening of construction activity, a phased return of non-essential retail, with obviously click and collect and garden centres being top of the list, but you'd like to see other retail open throughout May. And then obviously, you know, there's an expectation that personal services like your barber, your hairdressers and beauticians, etc., will open again also on a phased basis. And then you'll also have museums and galleries and libraries opening, and as well as some move on the mass numbers, I think it was referred to in one of the newspapers this morning. So that's what we know as of now, but I think there's also an expectation that the government will on Thursday set out a kind of a longer term plan, even in vague terms, as to what we can expect for June and July. And obviously there's been an awful lot of speculation around those longer term plans in the newspapers and across the media in recent days.
A plan for the rest of the summer then, what are you expecting to hear?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously, there's been an awful lot of attention around this ban on inter-county travel, because obviously, if we're not able to travel internationally, even in the short run, there is an expectation that there will be the ability to travel inter-county. Now, the ban is in place as of now until July. But obviously, you know, in the last week to 10 days, there's been an awful lot of talk, given the progress made, the relatively low rate of numbers compared to where we were.
And Danny, you've got a story on the front page of your newspaper, The Irish Examiner, this morning, talking about Troika-style spending reforms. What's that all about?
Yeah, so Michael McGrath, the Public Expenditure Minister, has essentially insisted that big spending departments, so be they health, education and social protection, have to start accounting for their spending throughout the year. This is a feature of the Troika programme when they were here. So basically there had to be quarterly accounting of how much money you're spending versus your allocation for the year. It's an idea, I suppose, essentially trying to begin the tracking of monies, both on the current side and the capital side. But it's part of a suite of measures that Michael McGrath has introduced in order to try and rein in the spending of big departments in relation to COVID-19. And as part of that, we're going to likely to see in the coming weeks is a kind of an unwinding of the PUP as a start, and the other wage support systems that have been put in place, because they're costing a huge amount of money. And what we know is that, you know, indicatively, money is going to have to, at least 8 billion worth of those supports are going to have to be removed from government spending between this year and next. And obviously this is all part of a process that's going to culminate in a special cabinet meeting at some point in May to begin that process of unwinding these extraordinary supports.
And before we left you earlier on, you were telling us about an expectation that this week a plan will be laid out, not just for May, but also for the rest of the summer.
Yeah. So the government are very clear that they don't want to just, I suppose, give us an indication of what's going to happen in May, but they want to set out what's going to happen for the rest of the summer. And the big ticket items there is going to be inter-county travel. It's going to be international travel, and that's all tied up with the EU digital green cert. And also, I suppose, what will happen with the hospitality sector, because if we're not travelling internationally, we're going to be having to holiday and staycate at home. We will want, obviously, an idea of what we can do and when we can do it. So I think there is an expectation, there had been an expectation building last week, that ban on inter-county travel would be lifted before July, but obviously over the weekend there's been a bit of caution, I suppose, re-entering the conversation. I think that may be tied to the return of Tony Holohan as Chief Medical Officer, but certainly the sort of expectations that were building throughout last year have been sort of dampened down. So I think that ban may remain in place until July, but I think what we will get is a kind of a roadmap throughout the summer as to when you can book your holidays, when you can expect to be able to have a pint and a meal, you know, out, either outdoor or an indoor. But I think if they don't give that, then I think, you know, that sort of pent up anger that's clearly there amongst many business sectors and amongst the public about the level of restrictions, I think that will only come to the fore. But I think there's an element the government recognise they need to set out where they're going, and be they on a phased basis throughout the summer, at least if you're given a direction of travel or a statement of intent, I think that will go a long way to assuage a lot of that pent up anger, as I said.
And we'll be hearing from some people whose lives are reopening a little bit more today, later in the programme. Daniel McConnell, political editor at the Irish Examiner, thank you.
And as part of the gradual easing of COVID-19 restrictions, after 120 days of being closed, golf courses have reopened this morning, with golfers across the country getting back into the swing of things. Our Midlands correspondent, Kieran Mullooly, is at County Longford Golf Club watching members hit their first tee shots this year. Kieran, it looks like they have the weather for it anyway.
Very much so, Angus. Greetings to you from the sunshine at County Longford Golf Club. They've been playing golf here since 1894. I'm looking out at glorious sunshine on the first tee this morning, and to my right I can see them coming in on the 18th. It's been a very busy morning. A lot of frustration here over the last number of months, but they're very pleased to be back. In a moment I'll be hearing not only about Longford but the situation around the country with Mark Kennelly here, Chief Executive of Golfing Ireland. But firstly, this morning I got an opportunity to speak to people as they began to play. Just after 7 o'clock they were there on the course. We'll be hearing shortly from Colm Hughes, who's the captain here in Longford. But I had a word with some of those teeing off in the early hours this morning.
Oh, the last 4 months has been very, very tough. Very tough on our members, because we're expecting them to keep paying their sub and supporters, so, which they all did, and thanks very much to the members. So they're looking forward to get back into fairways and play golf, and that's the long and the short of it.
Oh, sure, exhilarating. You wouldn't get me up at this hour of the morning for anything else.
So, and how have you missed it?
I've missed it, especially since the good weather came in. But I kept myself busy in the garden and in the house and whatnot, never looking as well. So we have all COVID gardens, COVID houses, etc. But yes, it was sad not being able to come down here.
Great to be back here in County Longford Golf Club. We've missed it. 120 days, I think, now since we had the opportunity to hit a ball. Looking forward to a whole summer of golf here in Ireland's hidden heartlands.
What have you been at for the last 120 days?
My wife has been very happy anyhow, because I've been cleaning out the attic and cleaning out sheds and cutting grass and painting walls, and that's all gone to the back burner now until hopefully we won't have a fourth wave of COVID.
Exactly.
It's tremendous to be back here in on the first tee, hitting off. Myself and Gary here now, and we look forward to 18 wonderful holes.
Yeah, that's some of the members of County Longford Golf are going out this morning after 7. I'd say there's probably over a dozen on the course at this stage. Annette Kane is the lady captain here. She's not out yet. She's beside me here, sitting looking out on the fairway of the first. And I suppose, firstly, there's one other point, I suppose. Apart from the golf, there's the social side of everything that's been missed over the last number of months.
Absolutely. People are beside themselves, you know, with frustration, I suppose, waiting to get out and play at a safe distance. It's a game that's easily played with distance and solo or any other way. And it's great to see so many out this morning.
There is, of course, a serious issue for you as a golf club. You have to keep things running. Your staff have been working, the course has been closed. Yet there was an ill wind did bring some good news during the year in terms of membership.
Oh, yeah. There was a great increase in membership. We got over 175 new people last year. We hope to expand this year again, and hope that young ladies and girls will take the opportunity to get to know a new sport. It's a great game. It's a skill game, and it takes brain and body to operate. So we hope to see lots of new young people coming in.
And just to clarify, those are members coming in from other sports as well during periods of the year when things were quiet in their own sports. As I say, Mark Kennelly, Chief Executive of Golfing Ireland, is beside me. Now, Mark, apart from the fun of it all, this is a serious business. Over 7,000 people directly employed in the golf clubs. So presumably today is an important day for the industry.
Yes, Ciarán, and today is a day that the golfers of Ireland have been really looking forward to and yearning for, and it's so wonderful to see the members of County Longford Golf Club out on the course here this morning, and they are joined by over 200,000 fellow golfers and over 300 clubs, all of which are opening today. So it's a really, really positive day for Irish golf, and you know, golf has come through a very tough year, like every other sector of the economy. Our clubs have been shut for nearly six of the last 12 months. So it's a very tough, and as you can see here, Ciarán, as even though the golfers are out on the course today, you know, the shop is closed, the restaurant is closed, the bar is closed, so those revenue-raising capacity of clubs won't come for some time yet.
Yeah, that was my question I was going to ask you finally. I mean, it is a serious business. Some clubs had undertaken huge developments, presumably their mortgages, their financial, their banks have been waiting. Have any clubs gone under in the last period, or are they getting some time to restart the repayments?
Well, Ciarán, the vast majority of our clubs, thankfully, have survived through the pandemic. We have been able to support about 145 of them with grant aid recently. But that said, it has been very tough. You know, many clubs have struggled. But as Lady Captain Annette just said, you know, the increase in membership has really helped a number of clubs. And our priority now in Golf Ireland is going to be to help clubs to retain those new members, because that's what will make our sport sustainable for the future.
Okay, thank you very much, Mark, and thanks as well to Annette for hosting us this morning here in the absolutely beautiful sunshine at County Longford Golf Course. They tell me that the clubhouse is closed, the 19th most certainly won't be open, but the course is open to members, and they have a busy schedule on the tees, I gather, for the rest of the day. So with that, it's back to you in the studio.
Lovely stuff. Ciarán Mullooly, County Longford Golf Club, thank you very much. Now, it's not just golf. Other outdoor sports, including tennis, also return today. They're in that fortunate position to be able to get back on court. And we can go to Kilkenny now, where we're joined by Shirley Johnson from Kilkenny Tennis Club. Good morning, Shirley.
Good morning, Angus. Thanks for having me on. And yet another great morning here in Kilkenny. Sun is shining and we're back on court at 7 o'clock this morning.
Fantastic. And tell me, have you had many people already out on court in the last 2 hours?
Yeah, there was. Yeah, I turned up at 7 o'clock this morning and there was 16 other members of the tennis club there ready to go. And indeed, we even had an octogenarian, one of our eight. We have two 80-year-old members who are active in the club.
Well, I wanted to ask you as well, reopening is fantastic, but there are safety measures, there are structures in place to make sure members and players are as safe as they can be.
Indeed, yeah. Tennis Ireland have been very helpful, our governing body, in helping us assist with some of the guidelines that we have to be compliant with, especially with relation to COVID. So we have an online booking system which makes it, encourages to social distance. I suppose the game lends itself to social distancing, which is great too. The hand sanitising stations are all set up on each court, and we encourage people to use them on entering and leaving the court. Enjoy their game, but also not to loiter around afterwards. The social aspect slightly has been pared away, but it is great to be back playing on court and to be able to serve up and volley a bit more than we have been. It's been a long 117 days since the ball was last hit on the courts in Kilkenny, but our membership is looking forward to playing over the next time.
And as you say, that membership quite broad, from five all the way up to, you've an octogenarian, as you said, back on court. And you've been preparing for this. You've been providing online yoga classes in the lead up to this to make sure members are fit and ready to go.
Yeah, there was an initiative run by the committee, which was gratefully accepted by the members. So we did a 6-week online yoga course, which just finished last week, in an effort to make members as supple and as strong as they could be when they return back to tennis. And also really as an injury prevention strategy as well. We're aware that people have been housebound for a long number of time over the last few months. So it was hopefully a health promotion strategy as well, to get people fit and active and enjoying the sport that they love too.
Absolutely. Well, listen, very best of luck with the reopening today, Shirley Johnson from Kilkenny Tennis Club, and thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks.